This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by the things we make. If you want to support Gregory Kamichuk, you can go to gmbkamichuk.ca. And if you think Justin Curry is just all right, you can go to chasingartwork.com.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am Gregory Kamichuk, known the world over as GMB Kamichuk, and I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork. And let's never forget producer extraordinaire Dan Vadebunker.
No one in the world knows me. I'm not known the world over for anything.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, I might be, actually. It's true. I might be something.
Because of the incident. But I don't think we should talk about that.
No, let's not.
On the show.
Dan's lawyer is doing a throat motion.
There's three lawyers. Each one of them holding up a different letter. Just says NDA. And they're just waving it furiously at us. If you're joining us for the very first time on this show, we are creative professionals who make stuff up for a living, write it down, put it into books, movies, television, plays, all kinds of stuff. If it has words and pictures in it, we love to work on it. And that comes with a very specific problem, something that I'd like to discuss today. We just came from a meeting that was addressing that specific problem, which is, when is it time to begin? You may remember the story of the truffula trees, Dan.
Yes, right? Of course.
Right? Yeah. The truffula trees, and you cut them all down and you make them into things that people don't
need.
The thneed that people don't need.
It's so funny how that sticks with you after all these years. I read that book to my kids so many times.
Right?
It just, it's still in my head.
And so getting bigger and bigger and bigger as a company can be a double-edged sword, because there is a way to give people what they want, but whether or not they should have it is a whole other thing. And when you're in the business of making up stories for a living, you want an audience. So this is the essential paradox of the problem as far as I see it. And then I'd like to discuss it once I lay it out.
Yeah, like to give the listeners kind of a sense of the scale that I'm thinking about in my head is, we have a convention coming up in Winnipeg, probably shortly after this podcast comes out, Icon Winnipeg. It's an anime show and a primary place where we get our art and books and creative out into the world is at these trade shows. And somebody who's starting out typically shows up to the show with one or two wheelie suitcases and maybe a backpack and takes over 4 feet of space and builds a little storefront and sells their stuff. And on the other end of that, somebody backs up a U-Haul sized truck, unloads 2 pallets worth of merchandise and trade show booth set up, and spends 8 hours constructing this environment for people to come into to buy their product, to buy their book, to buy their clothing. And at the end of the show, it's another 6 to 8 hours of collapsing that all down, putting it back onto a semi-truck, and it's off to the next show. So in my mind, that is the scale in our business a lot of time.
And there is one level beyond that as far as the point of sale, where the semi-truck comes up and they build those t-shirt towers, or they have 30 square feet.
I was just going to say, the t-shirt guys, speaking of at the end of the night, I remember closing down C4 one year, and we could not leave until these stupid t-shirt guys inventoried their entire stock after the show, before they packed it up. And it took forever, and we had to sit there and wait for them.
So there is a danger in getting big. Now, if all you're doing is selling a product that you, and let's be as inclusive as possible as far as like a unit. Let's just simply discuss it, not in terms of a book or a t-shirt or whatever, but just a unit. If you have a unit for sale, in our business, it's books that we have lovingly made. It is prints we have lovingly curated. It is enamel pins that
canvases.
It's all of these things that are our work from our imaginations put into the world. as an object. But people bring objects of all sorts. Sometimes they have been the authors or the makers of those objects, but often they are not. So if you're not, it's
Do you want it like that right there? That's the difference between an artist and a vendor. A vendor is just selling products that they buy wholesale and resell. I think we should stick to artists.
Well, we already exist in a gray area, though, Justin, my long-suffering co-host.
Don't you keep buying vendor tables?
Exactly.
Well, I can't fit in the artist tables
anymore. We can no longer fit in the artist tables.
I scaled up too much.
Oh, okay.
So we have to buy vendor booths, and we usually have to ask the shows, can our vendor booth be butted right up against Artist Alley? So
we want to be facing Artist Alley.
We are playing by the rules, right? Okay. You can't have this much space in Artist Alley. That's supposed to be curated for, as Justin described, people just trying it for the first time. But that's where our people are. The people who really like and connect with our stuff are the people who walk the Artist Alley floor. But we've reached that point in growth where we have to be Artist Alley adjacent in order to have the footprint that we need to have. I will also say some shows will let you build a big booth in Artist Alley, but it hurts the other artists when you do that.
The idea of Artist Alley is beginner artists, like non-professional artists most of the time.
Is that what that is?
I mean, depend. Like every convention has a little bit of a different definition. Yeah. But in a lot of conventions will limit. You can only get one table in Artist Alley. Yeah.
Yeah. But I would say that there's a range of skill, like people at all levels, right?
Absolutely.
You would have people just starting up, but also you guys are on the other end of that where you are expanding. And you also have, like, I would say artists who are just starting out would have maybe prints, probably not a lot of books or other kinds of products, whereas you guys have a whole range of different things you sell.
Oh, well, and we're sitting in a room filled with it right now.
Yeah. It's rare that you'd see books in Artist Alley. Like, it happens, don't get me wrong, but it's mostly like these people have full-time jobs or other ways of incomes besides their art. I'm generalizing. It's, of course, it's different all over the place.
And you get, in Comic Con land, you get A-listers are working for Marvel and DC who are tabling, and they're not interested in necessarily selling anything. They're there because people bring them books to sign
That's Guest Alley.
Yeah, they're...
But sometimes some cons blend it with Artist Alley. Some cons will bring in, like, one of those artists to be the head of Artist Alley or something like that. I've seen that.
So it's a vague world, but in general terms, when you first start, you have a small amount of space and you have a small amount of output. And if you are doing it as part of you have a 9-to-5 so that you can then work 5-to-9 on stuff that you really love. The Artist Alley is a great place for you because you can put all that effort into something that over 4 or 5 days, and maybe you do a few cons, it can work out. But Justin and I have made this our full-time endeavor, which means our output vastly outstrips what most people can. Simply by man hours, we're able to pour into our efforts. You know, the number of books and comics that we're able to produce on top of the prints and artwork that we make because we're working, you know, in some cases, 10, 12 hours a day every day of the year.
I mean,
maybe Justin's a little more than that some days.
No, it's actually, I've tried to balance
it. You've been getting
better? Yeah, I have. It's been a balanced summer.
That's it! I did see it! I told you! I was right! It's real! It's real!
Nancy, come back here!
So all of this to say, there comes a time when you've cut down so many trifle trees and they're all packed into those needs that not everyone needs, you ask yourself, is it worth it to get bigger, or is it better to maintain and hold the line? And what is the actual benefit to that scale up? So we were in a meeting, Eldon, I'll let Justin take it from here. But there's a logistics problem if you're moving from show to show, where you go from everything I can bring with me on a plane to no, impossible, now I have to ship it on a pallet. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
So you learned a few things that I think are worth sharing with our listeners who are maybe in that position of, oh, what if I ship things by pallet to shows?
Yeah. So it's the Toronto Fan Expo is the show in question that we've been discussing for a while now. We're at the point where I'm at the point where I need a palette for that show. It is 120,000 people come to that show. It's 4 days. Last year, girlfriend and I think took 5 suitcases between the two of us, arrived at a hotel where I had shipped boxes of books and had a whole bunch of canvases arrived. So it was like everything that we could carry, and then another ton of stuff was waiting for us there. So it was kind of like my inventory was kind of like scattered to the winds and came together. And at the end of the show, we had very little left.
You were still doing it like an artist as opposed to the business, which you have become.
Yeah.
And what I would say before you continue is that that all sounds very clumsy and difficult to deal with. And I believe you had issues with it. Didn't you last year or the year before?
So
at some point, you had issues with your stuff not getting there on time.
Oh, that was, well, Montreal, I had luggage not arrived.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, different problem. So that's actually another maybe silver lining to trying out this palette thing. So for those of you who don't know, these trade shows, Comic-Cons, happen all over the place, and they have setups with freight companies. So semis can be brought into the show, unload pallets. Pallets will then be taken from the loading dock and plopped at your booth. And if you're a huge booth like the Funko booth that has 12 pallets worth of Funkos, you know, that's not something that you can manhandle your way through airports and whatever. You need to get into freight. So for this show, I'm at that point where I want to have a pallet filled with way more stuff than I could ever physically bring, and way more stuff than I'd want to ship a little bit at a time, load it onto a pallet, have it waiting for me at my booth in Toronto, and then when the show is done, leave the pallet in the loading dock and be able to walk away and get on my flight without any bags checked.
Wow, that's going to be so much. It's like it's another level of convenience as well, right? Because it's so much less for you to worry about.
Yes.
Except, and I'll leave the names out to protect the innocent and the guilty, there are times when whole booths worth of stuff simply do not arrive.
Right.
And if you are bringing that much stuff to a big show, which already is that much more expensive, there is a not zero chance that all your stuff is missing.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, he could say that about anything, yeah, right? Everything. So it does, like, the fact that it'll be all in one place does scare me. But the idea that I can have more books than I could sell at a show that big, like, fills me with joy, that I could bring more Dragon Nannies than ever before, because every year...
And this is important, and I think that's what you're just going
to
say.
Right? I was going to say, you won't have to turn anybody away.
Yeah.
Right? You never turn anybody away.
Everybody, oh, here you go. Whatever product they want, you can give them, because you will have the inventory to support it.
But there's another side, too, which is the sad truth of human attention. Is that if they see a pile of something that's so big they don't even know how it could have got there, they pay attention to it in a way that if you just have 5 or 10 copies of something on a table, they don't. Mm. So if there is a ziggurat, as we've used the word before, of Dragon Nannies, they will say, my goodness, this book must matter. You know? And I don't like that about people, but it is 100% true that the bigger your display, you know,
this is triggering a memory from 2008 when little Justin Chasing, he wasn't chasing art at that point, just Justin Curry, the artist, had his little, he was sharing 4 feet of space with another artist, my very, very first table. And over in the distance, 6 tables worth of GMB Kamichuk, the ziggurat. And like, all I could think was like, that guy knows what he's doing. Like, that's some kind of big company. What is it like? But really, we were
comparable in our journeys.
But you had gone all out on your display, and I brought like a couple pieces of paper to put
down.
And the
difference was that a year or two before that, I had gone to San Diego Comic Con.
Right, and you saw what other people
were doing. And I saw what other people were doing, and I had told myself, you know, the constituent parts of the work almost don't matter when you're first trying to just get people's attention. Mm-hmm. Because if you put Justin's book on the table next to my book on the table, they're so different that if you like mine, you might buy it. And if you like Justin's, you might buy it. And if you like them both, you'd buy them both. But they're not really competing against each other in content.
Yeah.
Because people buy what they like. But whether or not you can get people to stop and look in it in the first place so that they can decide if they like it, that's the first sort of line of I mean, every person talking about branding will tell you that same thing, but I think about it in a different way. Because what you're trying to acquire as an author or as a creator are new readers, mm-hmm. not people who will just see it and go, "Ooh, I like it," and then put it on the shelf and never open it again. What you're actually hoping for is an intrinsic connection to the work, that they read it, they understand why you made it, they see the reasons underneath it, and they have a deeper connection to it and then want to pursue that. It's not about like, can I sell the maximum number of units, but can I get the maximum number of people who potentially would actually read it and like it to be sure. exposed to it in a
the
world
way
that
to increase the chances of that is
yes,
building big, that ziggurat.
Yeah.
Harry! It's your wife. She's right in the town looking for you. Come on, I gotta get you out of here.
No, she's me out there. She'll kill me. She's crazy.
It's a risk for you to do this, right? It's more money. Are you
going to
do this?
I'm 95% going to do this. There's a couple different reasons. This has been on my list to do for a while.
We've been talking about at least for 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I feel like I'm at that stage. I need to go through this process. I need to do this. Like, cost-wise, it is more expensive than what I usually do, but not like a crazy leap.
Well, it's Toronto,
yeah,
right, which is fairly close to here, and it's a pretty well-traveled route. So if anything's mm-hmm. nothing's going to go missing necessarily from here to Toronto, you know what I mean? Like, there's less to go wrong there, I think. And it's also a big show. It's a show you know you will do well at. You'll get a lot of people. So it's a calculated risk, but I think it's going to pay off. I think that you'll see... you'll get a sense of how it's all going to work, and you'll say, is it worth paying this much more to not have to worry about it?
And the other reason to do it is, you know, there's that old David Bowie quote about if you feel like you can barely touch ground and the water is just at your nose, you're probably doing the right thing, mm-hmm. right? You're ready for that
yeah.
next step. And that's because if you can take that risk now, it would open the door for that many more strange, Justin-driven, Gregory-driven personal projects, right? Remember that the whole goal here is to slide the publisher out of the equation.
Yeah.
The publisher who takes 80% of the profit and maybe or maybe doesn't help you when you need them. If you can push them out of the way, then it frees you up to follow those interesting creative endeavors, which is like the whole reason for the studio in the first place, is to make weird stuff that we want to make and then bring it to the maximum number of people as possible and see, are there people like us out there? And if the answer is yes, then you have a living. And if the answer is no, you still have controlled the maximum amount of the cash flow to the point where you can decide to do it a different way.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of when you went too big and it wasn't worth it? When you overexerted yourself on a trade show or at a booth?
The first FanQuest?
No, I liked it. No,
it was great. We just didn't have enough people. That was the only part of that part.
Okay, so that's yours. Yeah,
that's mine. Yeah,
that's yours.
We had everything there except for the people.
Yeah. In my instance,
it's the last C4. We each had, what was it, 6 tables?
Yeah, no, but those all work out.
Yeah.
That's because this is driven by our desire to bring work that we are like intimately passionate about to people who can then see it. So it's hard to see that as a loss, because like if you're having an art show and you hope, you know, 500 people will come, well, we're having an art show every couple of weekends and thousands of people come, not
yeah.
just for us, but
right.
you know, they see
yeah.
it. So you get that feedback. I will say that back in my misspent youth though, as far as biggering, I had a comic store, which we then expanded into a video rental store that combined comics.
The future was bright in video rentals.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the future was bright in video rentals. We had books, we had comics, we had video rentals. We had bought a video distribution business that brought VHS and DVDs, this new thing called DVD tapes, to mom and pop stores all over. See where I'm going here? Mom and pop stores.
Oh, I see what you're doing
over,
with that. Okay.
Right. So we had our store would order X number of copies of the movies, and then we would cycle them through the mom and pop stores in Winnipeg, all over Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And on the surface, without knowing the future was coming, It was a perfect business model. Everything you could possibly. We even bought, this was a big one for me. We bought 4 computers that you could LAN with at the store. So like the destination idea was like people would come to the store. They'd browse comics and then they'd be like, oh, I can also book internet time. Oh, on the internet, I can play like with my buddies. We can play LAN games. Oh, and you guys have 2 Slurpee machines. Oh, and I can rent a movie before I leave. And like it was a paradise. It was not, however, it was not a done thing to have all those things in the same place. So our real battle was to try and get, just like FanQuest, boots in the door.
Yeah.
The people who came got it, loved it, lived there, right? The people who didn't know it was there,
yeah,
you can't fault them for it.
Yeah.
Because there was no way to pick up that experience and put it in a busy place. You and I, Justin, are able to take our experience and put it in the busiest places literally on earth for our genres.
Yes, right? True. Yeah.
You're going to San Diego Comic-Con. There's no busier show than San Diego Comic-Con, right? New York Comic-Con. We can just go there with everything we like.
And I was going to say, that is biggering it too, because that, I mean, you guys are able to do that without necessarily scaling up your entire operation. You can still do the old school, go to Comic-Con with your suitcases for San Diego, right? Or do you ship stuff to San Diego?
That, no. Yeah, it's, everything's, it's
more expensive to ship to the States, right?
Everything's printed there.
Oh, I see. That's right. Yeah. You talked
and
about that.
And then I have a great relationship with my printer, so I'm actually shipping canvases and books and stuff to my printer, picking them all up in one place. But it's the same thing. It's instead of one package, I'm now concerned about 12 different packages. And so it seems like there has to be a better way.
Yeah. So the question was there a time when we biggered and it didn't pay off? What it meant was, for me, once I had all those different steps to manage, there was only one place I could scoop time from, and that was my personal life. And so the store became the all-encompassing 24/7 lifestyle. And the reason we closed it in the end was that my business partner and I, we both said, like, we're pretty good entrepreneurs, but we're being horrible husbands. And like I wasn't married at the time, and I had met the woman of my dreams, who we have now been together, lo, these many years. That we had a real talk to say, would we rather be entrepreneurs, or would we rather have our families? Because we're not going to be able to have both at this pace with this much stuff. And so we made it too big to not have a sacrifice to pay.
What year was this that you shut it down?
Oh gosh, I don't even think about that time now. That would have been 2003.
Perfect timing. Yeah. It was right at the 2004 was like when the bottom fell out of the video.
Yeah, we got out industry by accident just before, and we sold the distribution business separate from the store.
And you still like were you able to sell it? And
we sold it before the bottom fell. Like, we didn't know that was coming.
By the way,
it wasn't like haha. It was like, okay, well, we'll take so much on the dollar to move it.
Once she's in the booby hatch, throw the key away. That'll put you in the driver's seat.
Other things that you, other biggerings, as you've
word feels
labeled
dirty
it.
To me for some
yeah,
reason.
It is.
Well, other, I don't know what you Google, but for
other
me,
examples
it's fine.
Of
okay.
scale yeah. is like the product that we bring, and sometimes we try new products. So early in my career, I tried T-shirts. I did T-shirts once, and I remember I had a full-time job. I was doing a couple of conventions on the side. Everybody was telling me, you got to get into T-shirts, do some T-shirts. And so I paid an arm and a leg to get these Iron Man T-shirts printed to bring to a show.
Do you have a medium? Do you have a small? Do you have a large? Do you have an extra large?
And that's what happened. I brought these to a show. First of all, I didn't know how to properly display T-shirts. I didn't have a good setup for them. And the very first Winnipeg show, yeah, I think I sold all my mediums and then nothing else.
Yeah.
And maybe, yeah. So now there is still, to this day, and this is, yeah, from 2009, I still have like 6 or 12 of these sitting in a box somewhere, never to be used. So that's an idea. Like, sometimes you try things and they fall flat. With printing, we kind of do this all the time too. You have a piece, they're like, you do a show and, oh my God, everybody loves this piece. I'm going to need a million of these. Yeah. So you overprint it.
Yeah,
and then
that.
The rest of the world decides, you know what? No, we don't like this piece, or we don't like it anymore.
Yeah, and to scale, I've stopped. And actually, us working together, we've learned this, I think, not to print with your heart.
Yes.
Just print with your head. Like, whatever you think people are going to love, you are wrong. So instead, everything that you have, figure out what, you know, a good cost break is. In our case, we just try to do, we have a test printing. Like, we try to make it so that the bare minimum sales of a few of them would pay for a small run of the total set. And we just try everything.
If it bombs completely, it still pays for itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So even if only five or six people pick up a print, and now you, what you can't fix, you feature, oh, there's only 100 of these. Right. Mm-hmm. And then people are like, oh, amazing. And then maybe you only sell 15. And
now
then
it's popular. Oh my God, I need a million of these.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, don't do that. So, but again, now that I'm thinking about this, and this reminds me of a joke that, men don't go to therapy. They just start a podcast. So I guess this is us. I'm realizing that, Carl and my decision to put our families ahead of the business and rearrange our lives as a result, putting our heart ahead of the dollar, saved us from a real catastrophe. Because if we had gone all in,
the dollar
2004 was coming no matter what, right? And we would have lost it all. And so now we're in a business, at least my side of the studio, I'm in a business where my heart always comes first. Like, I want to work on this, so I'm going to work on it. I love working on it. I'm going to work on it. If I don't know I can make money on it, what I do is I make sure that I pair it with a winner. In your business aside, in your art practice, over a period of time, you know which ones people like. You know what the winner is. You're going to bring it, and people are always going to respond to it. So I make sure that when I'm traveling, I have a margin that is created, a little umbrella, a little shade that is cast by the winners, that as long as my experiment doesn't exceed the margin that the winners are going to make, I'll risk it, right? So if it means I come home only made 10% off my investment, but lost nothing, then it's fine.
And that's how I think you could think of this experiment, and another type of experiment in using freight instead of taking it all yourself. If you can make more money, or at least enough to cover the cost of it, by bringing more inventory, right? Because you won't be able to turn, you won't be turning people away. You'll be able to have that those books that would normally have sold out. If you can cover the cost, then that's your answer, right?
The other idea that goes along with this, if this works out, there's enough of us in the studio, enough of us in Winnipeg, instead of everybody taking their own stuff, okay, we have a studio palette that is, you know, half of my stuff and then a quarter of Gregory's and a quarter of Lyndon and Stevens, and we share that cost. And on the
maybe
way back, we have a lot.
Yeah. He has to decide to come to show.
Yeah.
And on the way back, too, we have all that room to come back with. Now, instead of divided by four, we can maybe take eight people's stuff
on the
way back.
So this is what I was going to say. So I was going to be devil's advocate, but you, in a way, you answered the question in a, you answered it before I asked it. How dare you, by the way, create such a horrific carbon footprint just for the dollars? But the truth is, if you can make it work, we'll actually lessen everybody's footprint because we'll all pile into one shipment instead of having 11 shipments all going to the same place.
Yeah.
Right. So in the long run, our scaling will mean that everybody's efforts kind of pile in and reduce that overall amount.
Well, and I also think that's on the companies who are doing all this transportation. That's really on them to start figuring that kind of stuff out as well.
Right. They won't though.
I know they won't. They won't until somebody forces them to, but somebody will eventually force them to, and then they'll.
Yeah. You know, we've already been seeking out all the alternatives for paper packaging and everything.
Yeah. Have we talked about that on, I think we've talked about that on the podcast.
We really had expressly a specific episode about that. We should do the talk
about. But related to the biggering, you know, we there's only so many pieces of plastic you want to throw into the world. And Justin has already killed so many dolphins as a result
sea turtles.
Of his bags. And the sea turtles died as a result of Justin's output, huge, enormous. So we're just trying to cut that down
Any
way we can. But the infrastructure is not there.
No.
It's so hard to try. And we've been trying. We put someone like
Have
your
you ever
job
handed
today.
Somebody a print by themselves? You get that look of disgust. Do you have a bag?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
and we have a person, you know, Lyndon has been working hard to find solutions, and it is not easy. And we've all worked hard to find solutions. And you can buy biodegradable packaging, say. But if you don't use it within 6 months, it all fuses together.
Oh, okay.
Right? So it's...
Technology's not there
we're
yet.
We're not quite there. Yeah. But needs must, right? So we're all trying our little bit. You know, well, we can't fix the world, but we can do a little bit. So if we can make it so that all of us aren't shipping stuff from all over the world, we're sending it in one tip of the spear on the, you know, good machine pallet, that would be amazing.
She'll tear up the whole town till she finds Harry.
Yeah, and then she'll tear up Harry.
There is a point in which getting big allows you to share some resources. If you get big enough, the margin is created by everyone else. You know, like we already do that with some of our printing discounts that we get for our printing. People in the studio or people that are recommended by us, we just try to share that love whenever we can. You know, so this is just.
And I think, like, since we've both started, we've always at every show when we're having a conversation after. We talk about what could we do better for next year? What would make next year better? It's like, oh, well, like for you example, Calgary, there was that snafu with your table. And instead of having three tables that you thought, you had like one table on a corner. So you had 1.5 tables instead of three, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, more space for next year.
Yeah, for sure.
Or...
If a pallet had come, I would have been in an enormous problem, though.
But I think that's like, it's a really healthy sign for us that we're always thinking, like, what can we do better for next year? What can we, what biggering, what scale can we improve upon for next year?
And the biggest thing that, you know, it seems small in general, but one of the things we do is like accommodations, right? So if, okay, this comes around to the following premise. I think power grows when you share it. So this is based on that premise. If you disagree with that premise, then of course you won't agree with what I'm saying. But if power grows because you share it, then a small example is we'll book out a house, say, in a city that we're going to be in for a week. And rather than say, ah, you know, we're going to live life large in this house, just the two of us. Instead, we tell everyone we're traveling with, hey, do you want to also have a room in this house? And we'll just divide the total cost. Mm-hmm. So that now it's a third of what your hotels would cost you, right? And you're staying in this big baller, you know, $1 million house or whatever.
And living large.
And living large, but all together as a group. And then we're all, you know, we make meals together. We hang out together. We share logistics. We try to share as much information as we do with some of the space that we have. And I'm hoping that the next biggering will also allow for that. You know, we've been talking with one of the shows about making a dedicated kind of alley. So that it won't really help us any more than it'll help anyone. It'll help the other people more than it'll help us, I guess is what I'm going to say. But in lending to your community, that's going to bring more people to the show. The more people that come to the show, the more readers people have, the more people are reading, the better the world is. And you know, the whole thing.
It also, it makes me a little sad inside when I see artists who I've known for like the last 10 years that have the exact same setup and travel with the exact same, almost like identical inventory that they have been for the last 10 years.
It must
and
work.
Nothing's changed. They're making a paycheck, but there's no, not having that growth just seems like you're stagnating.
It's almost like having a cubicle job.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should be telling anybody this, so I won't tell you how I got there. But I was on the roof of the Nutty Club building for the Canada Day.
Almost every time, I'm going to stop right now. Almost every time you end up on the roof of a building, you're not supposed to be there.
You're right.
So. For the dear listeners, what's the Nutty Club?
You know, you can go ahead and Google that. I don't want to give too many crumbs. But anyway, the point I'm making is we were up on this high roof beside the river overlooking the fork so that the huge drone show that they were doing for Canada Day, we were able to take in. It was very lovely. But looking down from that roof into the adjacent building, I saw hell itself. There was just this gray cubicle upon cubicle setup that I could look into. The lights, of course, are on in these office buildings all night for no reason I can
understand. Speaking of environmentally friendly.
Right.
Somebody's getting ahead.
Right.
That's, they're working late.
Just cubic, just hell itself. So the idea that you would go to Comic-Con and treat it like a cubicle job that is just the same every year, I don't know what those people are doing. Like, I cannot empathize with that mentality, especially if you yourself are the author of the work. Like, I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, publishing's hard. Being creative all the time is hard. It takes a lot out of you. And if now this is just a way that you found that you can just push print again, you don't have to put in any more effort. You know, there are a lot of reasons why people can't do what can't do it day in and day out. So I don't know, but yeah, it's hard. I look, I see those people too, and I think, oh no, do you just, can I give you a hug?
Like the wonder and impressment that you had for them 10 years ago has now just turned to like, disappointment. Like still, like you're not, nothing new, huh? Just same old.
They're just
same
counting old on the new people who to conventions. That's what that's what the customers are, right? The new, because there's always going to be new people coming to conventions.
Yeah.
So they're just happy to keep, you know, selling their stuff and getting new people to buy.
But so this brings us to an important point, as Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook are now in a period of decline.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Some more than others.
Right. Yeah, but they're actually, their user bases are shrinking, and the way in which they're selling ad space has meant that organic growth is basically impossible.
Yep.
The platform itself that people have put their time and energy into is not going to be there forever. You and I have had this conversation, and the pandemic, or the event as we call it here, proved this, that the platform that is show, someone else doing all the logistics to make sure that the traffic is there, right? When those go away, you have to have something else. And the something else was proven for both of us in that the stuff we loved the most about our business that we'd always put time into, even when it wasn't paying, making new work, became the thing that sustained us when all those platforms failed us by just presenting that new work through our own channels. And so if you don't have the new work and the platform disappears, then you're doomed. So those people who have been there just selling the same stuff over and over and over, should shows change? Should a law change? Should, you know, some law about single-use plastics or paper products come in?
Oh, God.
Then that's the end of that business, right? Mm-hmm. And those things happen, you know? We used to ride around in carts pulled by horses. Right?
Yeah.
Do you have any plans that you can reveal for an example of scaling up in the next 6 to 8 months, whether it be with a book release or Comic-Con?
Well, I can talk really specifically about it. That,
let's get into it.
Diamond Distributors, the worldwide distributor of comics all over North America, is crumbling under its own weight. And Marvel, DC, most of the big comic companies that used to distribute exclusively with Diamond have broken their exclusive contracts and have sought other distribution models and vendors. Come back with me, dear listener, to the 80s, when there were hundreds of distributors for comics. The black and white explosion, that's what gave you Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. This loss of monopoly is going to be amazing for comics and distribution.
We're getting close to, I don't want to get into it if it's going to take a long time, but so there was a bunch of distributors in the 80s.
Yeah.
Diamond took them over.
Yeah. I mean, and that's very simplistic, but essentially that's what happened.
One came out of it, basically. Taco Bell won.
There could only be
the
one.
Blockbuster.
The fast food wars.
Your Taco Demolition Bell. Man.
I know where my husband is. He's with that woman. I'll find him.
But now it's failing. It was because of the pandemic and shipping and all the inflation.
You know what?
Things.
No, I don't know if it was specifically. Now, this is hearsay, but what I'm hearing said is that because they were too big to fail, they started treating anyone but the bigs like they were nobodies.
Oh.
And so that meant that the low and middle of the distribution channel was getting no love, which meant they were all seeking alternate sources. And once they sought alternate sources and started finding them, the bigs looked at it and said, well, what are we paying so much to a middleman for when we're big enough to make our own choices and distribution channels. And so they started doing that, and the whole thing sort of
shook. So now it's all shifting.
Yeah. Look at what the effect Kickstarter had on direct distribution.
Yeah.
Right? There's so much. So to answer your question more specifically now, we have been looking at different distributors to carry this whole catalog of work in a way that allows me to curate, to be a little bespoke about it. I hate both of those words really these days, but you'll get what I mean. So that we can put little comic packages together and book packages together that feel more exclusive, that are direct to comic shops that are gets it. Like they really understand the value of something people that isn't mass market.
Okay.
You know, and leave the margins in place so that it works out. Now, this is by no means a done deal. This is exploratory, but that's a big step for me as far as biggering. I have enough content that is I consider to be evergreen. But in Diamond, you get one shot. You can list it once and that's it.
Well, that's stupid.
You can't list the same product again the next month. I mean, you can. I know. I can hear you guys all right now saying, but. There's a lot of buts. But for the way my business works, it doesn't work through Diamond. But it looks like it will work through a number of different distributors.
So that now there's going to be different options available for you. And you're saying that small mom and pop comic book stores or bookstores can access and order your work.
That's right.
Through this.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Right. And that I may make some exclusive work just for certain areas.
That's a great idea, because especially for, think about like bookstores and comic book stores, you guys do signings and appearances at when you do your little Western Canada tour, right? Those places can just order your books all the time.
Yeah.
You've built an audience in those cities, and now you can have a more direct connection to them.
Yeah. And this is an important point, I think. The reason that's possible for me is because the technology that allows books to be printed, allows books to be printed has changed.
Yeah.
So you used to have to print 10,000 of something, sell 5,000 of them, and throw the other 5,000 away in order to make your margin. But now you can print essentially on demand, close enough to a sale date through a distributor that you don't have to overprint, you don't have to create all this wastage, and you don't have to throw good money after bad in the hopes of hitting it. You can respond to the order in the time. There's a couple month lag between a distributor order and fulfillment that was never enough back in the old days to also produce your books and get them. They had to be already sort of produced.
Yeah.
Now you can respond to the market in a much faster way using current printing technology at a very high quality. Still do it local. I don't have to go to some other nation somewhere. I can do it in Canada. I can print on recycled material. I can do it the way I want to do it and still have it available to a quote unquote mass market. So that's big. And that's just because the technology is changing.
Cool.
How's that for an answer?
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Trying to think if I've got anything else to add. Like, and sometimes we've seen it too, going back to like booth spaces at Comic-Cons too, people buying too big of a booth for what they can actually fill, right? I think it's...
Too big too soon.
Yeah. Too big too soon. Yeah, I think we have done it organically, and every year we're trying to chip away at our scale and like a little bit bigger here. Let's upgrade this. Let's try something new here. And I think it's easy to walk into a convention and see that and go, okay, I want to do that and try to replicate it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a recipe for disaster. You need to start small, figure it out, slowly make changes, slowly build. It takes time. You got to figure it out. There's a lot of hurdles.
You'll see mid, and this will be sort of my last point on biggering related to publishing, I think. I've seen in the last 5-7 years, a number of new publishers show up big. You know, their peacock feathers are broad at shows. Big booths, big expensive displays, slates of really interesting products and IP. And what's underneath all of that are huge loans and buying up other people's IP. You want to publish with us? Great. We're going to control 60% of your IP. This is not how I want to do things. I don't want to grow at the expense of other people. And so what Justin is saying, going a little bit slow, responding to the market, getting a little too big for your own booth, and then wondering how could I possibly bring everything, and then saying, oh, what if I made the booth 10% bigger? Oh, now I have, that's what I needed, right? Like those kinds of things happening as you have, if you go too fast, you're going to overextend yourself. And particularly in these models, you're going to need to get that money from somewhere. And you'll hear a little voice in your head saying, other people's IP is valuable. Why don't you publish their work and take that IP and then start selling that on your own? And you've seen those IP farm models, and I won't name them, but there's five or six of those companies that started in the last 5-7 years. Maybe two of them have remained, right? Once their loans ran out and they didn't make the big Hollywood sale, they folded, right? And what happened to all those creators who signed books with them? They lost their IP.
Tragic. Mm. Yeah.
So you have to be careful that the biggering is following your heart, right? And not your head in some ways. It makes sense.
Yeah, that word biggering.
Does my heart make you bigger? I think this is all to say that we here at the studio have reached a point where we need some different logistics. And so we're trying to figure them out. And of course, we will share them with all of you, dear listeners, as we figure it out. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you that if you have an idea, you should absolutely make it. You should join the fight. You should make comics.
And then next year, make bigger, better comics.
And then the year after that, keep your booth the same size.